Welcome to this broadcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. My name's Mark Littlewood, Director General here at the IEA, and we recorded this on the 22nd of April 2020. Just a reminder that you can subscribe to all of the IEA's podcasts and broadcasts on Apple, Spotify and Podbean, and also on YouTube. If you're on YouTube, make sure that you subscribe to the IEA channel and hit the bell on the bottom right of your screen so that you get notifications of all of the content that will be pumped out. If you want to know more about our upcoming online events and our broadcast, please also visit our website, www.iea.org.uk, and there you can subscribe to our short, snappy, daily email news bulletin, IEA Daily, which will keep you abreast of what the IEA is up to. Thanks for joining us. I hope you enjoy listening. Well, today I'm joined by author, businessman, and most importantly of all, a very close friend of the Institute of Economic Affairs, Neil Monnery. Neil was educated at the University of Oxford and Harvard Business School. He worked for 20 years at the Boston Consulting Group as a director and senior vice president, before that having spent 10 years at WH Smith as group strategy director and chairman of Smith's News. He's the author of several books, including Safe as Houses, a historical analysis of property prices, Architect of Prosperity, Sir John Cowperthwaite and the Making of Hong Kong, and A Tale of Two Economies, Hong Kong, Cuba, and the Two Men Who Shaped Them. Neil's main research area is about how economic history can inform us and help us combat many of the issues that we face. And today we'll be discussing the rise of Hong Kong, what policies and individuals made that island rich, and what lessons we can actually learn from that in the UK over the long term, but specifically when we come out of the present economic lockdown. So, Neil, thank you very much indeed for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you as always.
Thank you very much.
So I want to start with your latest book. Late last year, you released your book, A Tale of Two Economies, Hong Kong, Cuba, and the Two Men Who Shaped Them. Tell us a little about those two economies, their two stories, and the two leading men in your narrative.
Well, I'd written this book on Hong Kong, which looked very much at its, as you said, at its post-war economic growth and the huge success it has had. The role that John Cowperthwaite played as financial secretary, which we'll talk about no doubt a bit more in a moment. But I was in Cuba and I realized that at pretty much the same time that John Cowperthwaite was under pressure to turn Hong Kong into a mixed economy with much higher level of state involvement, Cuba also was having a decision about how to take their economy forward. Batista had been overthrown by Castro, and in the very late 1950s, very early 1960s, he delegated off to Che Guevara, interestingly enough, who most people think of as a guerrilla fighter, but in fact ran the National Bank, was the economic minister for industry, ran the agricultural economic program of redistribution. And Che Guevara was put in charge of trying to find the best route forward to bring prosperity to Cuba. So the setup essentially is that these two very important figures in around 1960 had a choice. One chose laissez-faire, capitalism, economic freedom. The other chose planning, state control, state ownership, and ended up with very different results. And the reason I've picked these two is I think they both had in some ways very similar intentions. They wanted to bring good policies to bear so that they would improve the lot of their people. It's just one worked a hell of a lot better than the other. The other key point really is that because in fact neither is a proper democracy in a way, they've stuck with those economic policies for 60 years. So we have this enormously long, stable period of economic policy and the results that it delivers.
So can you tell us a bit about those results? I mean, I think a good bunch of the IEA audience will sort of assume that Hong Kong's been a great success, Cuba a socialist disaster, but what were the results? I mean, what numbers or figures can be attached to these two different stories, these two different experiments?
Well, in 1960, just as Cowperthwaite was becoming financial secretary and Che Guevara was becoming minister of industry and so on, Cuba and Hong Kong had approximately the same GDP per capita, about $4,500 per person in today's money. Hong Kong is now 14 times richer than that over the 70-year period till today, and Cuba is twice as rich. It probably isn't even twice as rich, because actually quite a lot of that is remittances from Cubans who settled in America. Around 2 million Cubans left Cuba to go to America, and they remit money back into the economy. It's about a sevenfold or more difference in relative prosperity increase over that period. If you live in Hong Kong, you are now amongst the richest people in the world, roughly the same income per capita purchasing power parity as the US or Switzerland, and materially richer than Britain, it's important to note, so about 40% richer than the British GDP per capita.
And you've obviously, I'll come specifically to Calpafate in a minute, you've obviously studied Hong Kong and its colossal economic success in some depth, but I'm intrigued, do you have any theories as to why Cuba and Che Guevara seem to be icons, heroes, to very, very many people? And Calpafate is barely known. Certainly, I've seen, on university
campuses. You and I are probably the only two who know about it.
university campuses across the globe, you'll see sort of that famous iconic image of Che Guevara, albeit more in kind of combat fatigues rather than running a national bank. Cuba solidarity campaigns are part and parcel of sort of left-wing politics. But the numbers you've just given, it should be the other way around, shouldn't it? I mean, there should be, students should be wearing T-shirts with a picture of John Calpafate on the front. Why, given those stunning statistics of the sort of sevenfold improvement that you get in Hong Kong compared to Cuba, why have these sort of obvious lessons of economic history apparently not been learned, or have not become embedded in our culture in some way?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a terribly important question, really. What you've got to remember in Cuba is that the Castro and Guevara administration, if you like, followed a crony capitalist period under Batista. And the people, the mass of the people had not benefited at all very much under that period of crony capitalism. Therefore, as people try and look at a way out of that, they went with a group that was trying to overthrow that government. In fact, at the beginning, Castro was very clear that he was not a communist. And in fact, the prime minister and president immediately after the revolution were both liberals. But eventually it turned into communism. But I think it's very important to differentiate between free market capitalism, as we see in Hong Kong, and crony capitalism, as was existing in Cuba. And as you know, in politics, you don't really get a choice as to what you overthrow your bad government with. You normally have one option. Maybe you have two, but you probably only have one. So in a battle between crony capitalism and socialism, it's a much tighter fight than it is between free market capitalism as we have in Hong Kong. And you can see the defense that certain people in Hong Kong over the years have put into defending the capitalist system there, which is not the case that under the Batista system in Cuba. The other thing I think is terribly critical is the time horizon. If you only have a 1 or a 2% difference in growth rate, it doesn't feel that much this year. But the reason Hong Kong is massively wealthier is because it's had a 1 or 2% difference for 70 years. It's just that steady improvement in standards of living, which is almost imperceptible. As we know, governments can throw it away, give it away in bungs for various interest groups and the like. And if you do that and you deteriorate back to very low levels of growth, then of course capitalism isn't delivering. So the great thing about Hong Kong, I think, over the period that we're talking about, is that it had a phenomenal performance in terms of growth rate because of the system that was put in place by people like Calpafate. And then the very last point I'd make is there is something mildly romantic about the socialist idea as displayed by in Cuba, about we're all in it together and so on. And it does require a certain level of willingness to think about over the longer term which system will work best for the majority of people. It's quite a hard thing, I think. It's not what we're naturally intuitively feeling is the right answer, to allow it to the markets, to allow. But it is, of course, by allowing many of these things to go down to distributed people, to the competition between companies, to people choosing what jobs to have. It's those things that deliver long-term prosperity. The planning side doesn't really do it.
So would it be fair to say, in the case of Hong Kong, and I want to come to Kapofwe in a minute and the precise policies he enacted or stopped, you've got a kind of long, slow and steady eventual miracle of compound mathematics, because those growth rates, you know, are on top of each other, and therefore after a generation or two, it makes a colossal difference. Whereas in Cuba, you have the sort of short, sharp shock. You know, we need the empowerment and the emancipation of the masses now. So that sort of socialist revolution, which promises a lot, I mean, maybe it doesn't deliver, but promises a lot immediately. Whereas there's something sort of slightly more methodical, small C conservative and longer term about the Hong Kong story.
Yes, I think that's right. Cuba, of course, has had very low growth rates for a very long period as well. So it's been methodically growing very slowly. I think the key difference is that in Hong Kong, investment choices have been made by people who are seeking a profit, are looking for opportunities, whether they themselves change jobs or what industry they open up. Hong Kong has led in various in very many different industries. It was in the entrepôt trade to begin with, and then it went into various services around shipping, and then it went into manufacturing, and then it went into plastics. It's been extremely agile in the way in which it's deployed its capital over the time. Cuba decided with a big five-year plan, very similar to the Soviet Union approach, as to what it wanted to build by way of industry. And it was a very static, very undynamic way of doing it. But it was very driven by the top. So you had a very, if you like, a clear, ambitious plan, as you described it. But unfortunately, it isn't very agile in the face of uncertainty, in the face of changing economics, and therefore has delivered this very slow growth rate for many, many decades.
It sort of looks good in contemplation, but is disappointing in effect, essentially, the Cuba case.
Yes, and it's you know, we see it throughout Europe as well, and in the UK, there is something that people like about the government taking control of something and showing action. But of course, sometimes that action isn't very helpful in the longer term. And in fact, you would have been better off leaving it to markets. Leaving it to markets has a problem. Which is the Schumpeter logic in economics, which is, therefore, firms will fail. And that is an integral part of the system. And one of the successes in Hong Kong is not to be overwhelmed by empathy, if you like, for those firms that fail, but rather to see that as a reallocation of resources to better uses.
And part of the market
recovery
process.
That is the hard
thing
for people to feel is a good thing. Yes, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about John Kapofwe. You and I have shared a number of conversations about this, but let's assume for the listeners and the viewers that they don't really know much about him. So in 2017, you write this book entitled Architect of Prosperity. Why did you pick Kapofwe? And tell us a bit about him, because he's, although I think his legacy is hugely significant, he's hardly one of the best known sort of classical liberals or free marketeers. So give us a kind of new reader's start here introduction to what he did.
Well, I actually started doing some research after the great financial crash. I mean, we're now in another crash at the moment, but it was after the 2007-08 crash. And I thought it was very problematic that we didn't have good examples of how to have good levels of growth over the long term. And I think subsequently we've had very low productivity since that point and very low levels of economic growth. And I wanted to look around the world to see who had not only moved from relative poverty to high levels of income, but past our level of income and actually even higher. And Hong Kong kept popping up as this remarkable economic story, which I think has been massively undercovered by economists and politicians and the like, for maybe some obvious reasons. And as I dug into the success of Hong Kong, which, as I mentioned, was 60 or 70 years of extremely high levels of growth, this name kept coming up, which I also had not heard of, John Cowperthwaite. And so I started researching him. He has left a very light footprint in terms of documents or biographies, i.e. none. And as I read about him, as I visited the archives in Kew in the UK and in Hong Kong, I came to find a great deal of interest in what he had done by way of economic policy, a set of economic policies that are not widely used today and perhaps have gone rather out of fashion in most countries, of leaving things to markets, of an open economy, of laissez-faire. And yet the results are very, very clear. And I thought that was worth airing a bit further and examining a bit further. And that's what the book's about.
Yeah, tell us a bit about Cowperthwaite. So, okay, he's a laissez-faire, sort of inspired by Adam Smith, sort of free market kind of guy. But what did that mean in practice in Hong Kong after the Second World War?
Yeah, it's worth it. He basically was a classicist. He went to St. Andrews and then to Cambridge and probably would have ended up as a classics professor or a teacher in a leading school or whatever. But then the Second World War intervened and he joined the civil service and in particular a thing called the Hong Kong Cadets, which is a high-flying group of Hong Kong civil servants. And fortunately, he just avoided ending up in Hong Kong just before the Japanese invasion. So he spent most of the war actually in Sierra Leone, but he turned up in Hong Kong immediately after the liberation of Hong Kong in the autumn of 1945 and took various roles, first of all, in charge of price control and finding supplies like rice and heating materials and getting the economy back on its feet. The economy was completely desolate. Everything that had got any value had been taken away by the Japanese or destroyed. The population had roughly halved. All of the Europeans were interned in prisoner of war camps. It was really a barren island. And Britain was not really in a position to provide much economic support to Hong Kong. So they had to sort of find their own way. And what they ended up doing was putting a lot of trust in the Hong Kong people and the Hong Kong institutions to be able to revive the economy very quickly. And that is in fact what happened. So in many ways, the government played an enabling, but absolutely not much more than enabling role in the recovery of Hong Kong. And very quickly, it had returned to its pre-war level of population, its pre-war income per capita. It had reestablished the entrepôt trade with China. It then went through a series of subsequent shocks as well. For example, when the US put a trade embargo on China, which completely destroyed the economic basis of the colony. And again, that was the 1960 time. And there was a huge pressure for the government to intervene, which Cowperthwaite, at that point, who was financial secretary, resisted, again, leaving it to individuals, to companies, and to markets in order to bring prosperity. And at least in the case of Hong Kong, that is what has happened. So he was a British civil servant. He was not an ideologue. He wasn't an economic proponent or whatever. He was simply interested in trying to pursue the best economic policies for Hong Kong. There's quite a degree of immigration from China at that point, China going communist, great flows coming in. He needed to ensure that there was enough work and he left it to the markets largely to achieve that, but not from an purely ideological basis. It was from the perspective of what it was that pragmatically worked. And as a British civil servant, surrounded by other British civil servants in the governor and the colonial secretary and so on, I mean, they were trying to find a route forward for the responsibilities that they had.
So in practical terms, did that mean that, I guess I've got two questions here. Did that mean that Cowperthwaite's approach was not really to roll out policies or programs, but simply to resist them, to sort of say, you know, stop, don't do this, don't do that, that it's a sort of a kind of Mr. No approach, you know, just to sort of stop the bad things rather than having a whole bucket load of weird, wacky and wonderful manifesto ideas. And what did that say about, what lessons can we learn from that? I mean, was it just a one-off? Why aren't there more people like him? What was required in order to achieve that? What was the secret of his sort of self-denying ordinance, if you will?
Well, I think in your first point, you're absolutely right. It was an issue of, in the whole, ruling out interventions. His successor, Sir Philip Haddon Cave, he called it positive non-interventionism and described that as essentially taking the view that it's normally futile to intervene in an economy to change the growth rate of that economy, however attractive that should look at the moment, however intriguing as a government or whatever. So, but it is important, it's positive non-interventionism, which he described as being the case where your ingoing assumption should be that you shouldn't intervene, but there will be occasions where you should, because of market failure, because of desperate need, whatever it is. So it was simply a stance. And certainly Capplethwaite would turn up at the office very early in the morning and stay very late. And he said to someone, I have to do that. It's the only way I can ensure that stuff doesn't happen. if I went off early or came in late, somebody would have agreed to some initiative or proposal and I have to be there to ensure they don't. So I think it is an unusual philosophy. Now, it's a difficult philosophy in a democracy, I think. So one of the things that helped Capplethwaite very much was that he, in a sense, didn't have to be re-elected. And therefore he could stick to his guns, to his principles, in a way that is probably very difficult in a democratic system. That said, there are, I think, interesting examples, and my current favourite would be Switzerland, which I think has a structure of high levels of democracy and development, alongside an ability to keep spending through the referenda and the canton system under control, with huge public support to do that. So I do think it's very difficult. We can't simply pick up the Hong Kong system and use it elsewhere. It needs to be adapted to the right situation. But the essential concept of ensuring that there's a high level of investment into productive industries and using that mechanism to allocate resources to the right place and thereby get high levels of growth and subsequently allow that to go down into services and other things. That essential model, I think, is a fundamentally interesting question for many economies to have a think about whether that wouldn't serve them better in the long run.
And you've done a great public service, Neil, if I may say so, by your books and bringing him to public attention. But I'm still fascinated as to your explanation as to sort of why he isn't more of a hero for liberals or an icon. I mean, people might talk in sort of shorthand terms when people talk about free markets about Thatcherism or Reaganomics or some such. Like, I don't think I've ever heard the term Capplethwaiteism. I mean, I might just think it's a bit of a mouthful, but almost, I guess I'm asking is, why have your endeavours in writing these books been necessary? It seems to me absolutely astonishing that he isn't a celebrated individual. I mean, we're probably looking at the economic growth rates on planet Earth, thanks to his policies under that particular period of time, there or thereabouts?
Pretty much. I mean, pretty much Hong Kong between, say, 1945 or 1950, if you ignore the original rebound out of the war, and say 2010 or even to today, will have the best, if not, you know, one of the top two or three best growth rates of any country over that period in the world. So it is remarkable that we don't pay more attention. And it's not just Capplethwaite. I mean, he had predecessors who were, again, civil servants who followed a very similar course, and he had successors who followed a very similar course. Indeed, I had the opportunity to talk to the current holder of the Office of Financial Secretary in Hong Kong, and they broadly follow the same set of policies that he introduced or was central to explaining and describing and embedding in the 50s and 60s. So I too am amazed that people aren't more interested in seeing more about a story like that. I mean, there are a handful of great stories out there where I think people who are interested in economic prosperity really need to have a good knowledge of them. Singapore is another example. I mean, Singapore is, you know, people talk about the high levels of planning, but they ignore the fact that the government in Singapore is well below half the size of the British government in terms of a share of the economy. And of course, there's Taiwan. And there are many others, but I think what intrigues me particularly about Hong Kong, and Singapore actually would be much the same, is that they have kept this up for a very long period. And it has taken them not just from a third of our living standards to a half or something, they have surpassed us. And therefore we know it's not just simply getting up to the growth boundary, if you like.
It's not just catch up.
We need to catch up with them. We need to understand that. And therefore I would have thought serve people well to understand those models carefully. It's the same on the flip side, on the Cuba type side. I think, you know, there were roughly 45 or so centrally planned communist economies in 1960. There are now two, Cuba and North Korea, that's all that's left. We need to understand, and I know the IA has done much on this, why is it that central planning of the economy is such a disaster to prosperity for the people of those economies? Mm-hmm. There's no statistical doubt about it. But an understanding about what it is we need to avoid if we are interested in the prosperity of people throughout our economy and our country, that would seem to me to be absolutely central.
I wonder if you could just sketch out for us a little bit more about, if you like, what are the lessons we're trying to learn here? You said at the outset, you know, Hong Kong gone up in GDP per capita by a factor of 14, Cuba only doubled, so, you know, seven times more successful in comparison. Yeah. But what, tell us a little bit about the shape and size of these, the way the government operates. You mentioned Singapore, but if we were to look at GDP spending by the state as a kind of proxy for how big the state is, what does that look like in Hong Kong compared to Cuba and compared indeed to the UK or Western Europe? What are the sort of rough metrics there in comparing those three?
Well, Hong Kong around the time of Kapithwaite, so the 50s and 60s, was 15 or 16% of GDP was the size of the state. It's now still below 20. So that's creeped up a tiny bit, particularly with the provision of free education and pensions and social security networks and so on, but to about 20%. Britain, I think, was about 45% to 50%, but I think it's going to be a little bit higher than that. So well above double. Switzerland, interestingly, is around 30%, which is why I think it is a really intriguing example. And Singapore, which again I think is a very valuable example, is below 20% too. So I think it gives you a sort of sense as to how you can be an extremely successful and powerful economy with a much smaller state sector. In fact, you know, the Kapithwaite argument would be you need the smaller state sector, not because you don't like providing services or whatever, but simply because if you don't control that, you won't have enough investment, you won't give enough money back to companies, to individuals and so on, therefore you won't have enough investment, and it is that that is central to the growth going forward. It is people exiting one industry and moving into another and building it and getting their investments in the right place. And that's what Cuba, on the share of the government is very difficult because it's effectively 100%, or it's 95%. So there's a huge set of academic literature around what are those numbers. But effectively, we can say almost all, and I'll come back to one exception in a second, almost all of Cuban economic activity is controlled by the state and has been really since the 1960s. The one exception to that is when the Cuban economy is extremely reliant on sugar, and Russia, the USSR, had given them a big subsidy for buying their sugar for many years. But when the Soviet Union disintegrated, that subsidy went. And Castro actually allowed a certain degree of liberalization, and certain people could become self-employed. I think it was 159 jobs, including jugglers and taxi drivers. You could rent out one room, and 600,000 Cubans, which is actually quite a significant part of the workforce, have taken advantage of that. And if you go to Cuba, you find very entrepreneurial taxi drivers, restaurants now, and so on. But it is very much controlled, and it's a clear problem for the state in terms of trying to how do they manage that. They have a desperate need to try and control and manage it, but it is interesting. There's a little flourishing sector there. The other one I think people need to reflect on, which I certainly hadn't fully realized, and I think is extremely interesting, is China. China effectively has become a market economy in a very large part of its economic sphere, whilst not in any way liberalizing its political system. And therefore, in fact, in many ways, China, the success bit of China, is largely through the power of markets. And many people would argue that actually it is because the Chinese leadership saw the success of Hong Kong and Singapore that they felt more comfortable in liberalizing after the Mao period, where there had been a series of economic disasters and famines even, that they felt more comfortable or saw the need. I mean, it was obviously highly contentious, saw the need to free up the markets there.
That's really interesting. Now, what I'm interested in teasing out of you are to what extent can we in the UK or the Western world or Western Europe learn these lessons? I mean, you've mentioned in your remarks that you think that Hong Kong not being a democracy was a potentially helpful element of this, that if you're a traditional Western democracy, you're under much more pressure to act now or to spend this now or to get a headline tomorrow. So Capital Fate had, if you like, the ability to think more long term, perhaps, than Western politicians. But you also see, I mean, I was looking up Hong Kong in the Fraser Institute's Index of Freedom, and I think virtually every year it comes out number one. I think one year since 1970 it didn't top the charts. But if you look at social freedoms, well, not such a stunning success. I mean, somewhere in 20th, 30th place, somewhere around there. Yeah. So is it really possible to sort of cut and paste the Hong Kong experiment onto the United Kingdom? Or do you require a kind of only a pseudo-democracy in order to be able to do that? Do we actually have to learn more from the Swiss than we can learn from Cowperthwaite?
Well, I totally agree that I think there are elements of the Hong Kong system that wouldn't fit, and we wouldn't want to fit. So, or wouldn't want to engage with. But I think that what Hong Kong provides is, if you like, a limit example or example of where the limits come on in trying to create high levels of prosperity over the long run. You then have to move away from that, I think, to sort of say, well, this bit of social freedom or whatever, I'm not willing to give up, and therefore I'm willing to take the trade-off of a lower level of economic growth in order to have that. And that, of course, is entirely to be celebrated, and it's the right thing, which is one of the reasons I quite like Switzerland, because I don't think anyone's going to argue the Swiss have got a backward approach to many of the provision of healthcare or provision of education and so on, the key functions of the state. Nor I think Singapore, which is a democracy. So I think it's not as simple as saying you can't do it if you're a democracy. I think the difficulty is getting consent and creating a consensus that it is in the long-term interests of future generations, our children, our children's children, to have a higher level of economic growth, and that does require certain constraints on policy today. If you don't have the consent and consensus around that, then I think it is very hard. I can't remember the exact number, but I put in the book on Cuba and Hong Kong, the number of lobbyists that exist in Brussels and in Washington. Now, obviously, they exist for the reason that they believe they can earn a high return on lobbying politicians, otherwise they wouldn't exist. So, you know, we shouldn't pretend we've got some amazing system at the moment that is only working for the long-term future of everyone in the country. Sure. We have elements of crony capitalism in all of the major Western economies. And the issue is do we want to improve the power of markets? Do we want to push forward the open economy? Do we want to allow people freedom to move their investments and their jobs around as appropriate? Do we want to not bail out every firm that's not doing well? Do we want to sort of not create a champions plan, which, you know, has never worked? So I think there's a set of things, and it'll be difficult because it's, in a way, much easier to accept the lobbyist's view, accept the media's view, and to intervene. But I do think that can be at the cost of long-term prosperity.
So I think I'm going to finish by asking you, and you've already said some of the difficulties in making comparisons, and I'm now going to make an inappropriate comparison to compare the world exiting the coronavirus to the world exiting the Second World War. I mean, they're not really on the same scale or the same thing at all. But at least there's a similarity in terms of the immediate economic picture is going to be bleak, right? I mean, government spending will be very high as a proportion of GDP in the UK this year. There will be a lot of stress in the private sector and all of those pressures you've just mentioned. You know, we can't let this business go to the wall or that business go to the wall. Let's try and preserve things as they are. If you could channel the spirit of John Cowperthwaite to advise the present UK government as we begin to turn our attention to exiting from lockdown, let's hope in a few weeks' time rather than a few months' time, facing very substantial budget deficit, very high levels of government spending, a strictly regulated economy, probably a lot of pressure for economic nationalism rather than free trade as a consequence of this. All of those sort of pressures, all of the sort of pressures that would have been on Cowperthwaite are likely to be similar in some size, shape or form to those that will face the British government. Could you do a little to sort of forward wind, perhaps, you know, 3, 4, 6 or 8 weeks? What would the ghost of John Cowperthwaite be saying to the Boris Johnsons and the Rishi Sunaks and the Priti Patels and the Dominic Raabs about the path that they should chart in the weeks and months to come to ensure good growth rates and wider prosperity in the UK coming out of this economic and human catastrophe?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I'm doing some research around that at the moment as to what have economic parallels been in the past as you come out of these very dramatic declines in economic output and so on. And we're definitely going to be in that situation. And I do think there are parallels. Obviously, it's very different in terms of what the cause of the problem is and the nature of the public health issue. But in the economic terms, I mean, Cowperthwaite came and arrived in a Hong Kong that had, suffered a major economic shock. And I think it took him some time to realise that the best route out of that actually was to allow market forces. Once there was a reasonable form of government, there was a currency back and so on. So, you know, it doesn't work if you don't have some very basic rule of law, sanctity of contracts and stuff like that. But once you've got that in place, that it is the entrepreneurial drive and spirit that actually gets you to the better allocation of resources and the higher growth rates, which then cascade back into higher wages and better provision of public services. Now, I think the great problem is that if you go through a shock like we're going through at the moment with the coronavirus, there is a great temptation to say, well, what we need is more state intervention. What we need is greater regulation. You may even argue that, you know, the state has showed some level of effectiveness in doing that, although that is clearly going to be a highly debated point on how effective or not the government was in different spheres of activity. But I think you're right, there's a great problem. We've been through that quite recently with the great financial crash, where we've sort of said, well, we can't allow the banks to fail, so we need to intervene, and we've got to support the clients of the banks and hedge fund managers. Now we've just done it again with a whole new set. So there's a real problem, which is someone's going to come along, or there's going to be another crisis, and they're going to say, well, why don't you bail me out too? Because you bailed everyone else out. Yep. So there's huge problems. And I think, and you can absolutely see why the government intervened as it did in the policies to date. I think what I would advise is it's very important to say what was done in an emergency situation in order to deal with emergency problems is not necessarily the right model for how we create long-term prosperity. And in order to create long-term prosperity, indeed, we may need to go to a completely different model, you know, much more around free markets and open economies, greater specialization and the like. And that will be very hard to, you have to be quite brave, I think, to do that. If you take the period after the Second World War, Britain had a choice, really, and it made a very bad choice. It made a choice to nationalize, to use very limited resources on nationalizing industries, on putting in place some very valid forms of social security and the like, but also some stuff that didn't really work. It tried to do centralized planning in many industries. And Britain, if you may remember, you won't remember, but as you may recall from the books, had huge economic problems with devaluations, inability to raise capital for investment, and was starved out of markets for a very long time, depressing the growth rate. Even rationing in Britain didn't stop till the 1950s. So, you know, way after, say, somewhere like Hong Kong. So I think the great decision that's going to exist after we're through the public health crisis is that key one of what is the right route to economic prosperity for the society as a whole. And if we could get our leaders to focus in on that and then try and get consensus and consent on the path that involves, that would, I think, be fantastic.
Neil, thank you so much for joining us for this IEA podcast. Thank you also for your kind of personal crusade to bring John Cowperthwaite to public attention. It seems to me not
and
before time and much later. And Che Guevara. Well, he was already in public attention. You've written the books to bring into public attention. I'm going to make it my mission to start making John Cowperthwaite posters and T-shirts to rival Che Guevara posters and T-shirts. It's been absolutely fascinating to hear from you, Neil. It's always a pleasure to host you at the IEA. Thank you very much for your time. In the show notes below, if you're watching on YouTube, we'll link to Neil's books on Amazon. I highly commend them. And Neil, no doubt this is a subject that we will be returning to again and again as we exit finally the pandemic and lockdown, and we look for where we can learn lessons. And I found what you were saying about the lessons to learn are, if you like, obvious but are hard to sell is going to be the real challenge for those of us who are free market liberals. So Neil Monnery, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you very much.
So thanks again for joining us. I hope you enjoyed the broadcast with Neil Monnery. Just to remind you, you can subscribe to the IEA's content on Apple, Spotify and Podbean. If you're watching us on YouTube, make sure you hit subscribe to join our channel, and also make sure you ding the bell in order to receive notifications of all of our upcoming broadcasts. To keep up to date with us and our upcoming episodes, vidcasts and podcasts, please visit the IEA website. That's www.iea.org.uk, where you can also sign up for our free daily email news bulletin. Thanks again.